and good morning from the mighty Boo, KBOO Portland. Just before 9 o'clock on your Thursday morning, in a half hour from now, it's KBOO's Linda Olsen Osterlin hosting A Deeper Look. Today's show features Jerry Haynes, a local nurse who recently returned from a medical mission to Gaza. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoint's Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman explores the sci-fi world of sleep donation created by author Karen Russell in her book A Crisis of Insomnia Has Swept Across America, and healthy dreamers are recruited to donate sleep to the insomniacs under the watchful eye of the Storch Brothers Corporation. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, KBOO's monthly program on comics and animation. The show will feature comics artist Lucy Bellwood, who has teamed up with journalists to report on Islamic environmentalists and the women of Gitmo, and will have a show in Portland this September. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a current member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today. Stick around. Up next, join Teresa Mitchell for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know.
The attacks on Gaza and the devastating humanitarian crisis there is unfolding before our eyes. Environmental health conditions were grave there before these latest attacks. Many would like to do something to help the people there. Nurse Jerry Haynes has been able to do just that. Join me, Linda Olsen Osterlin, on A Deeper Look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. Back from an April delegation of medical professionals and preparing to go again in October, Jerry Haynes of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility will give us a feet-on-the-ground account of the people of Gaza and the conditions they face. That's this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Well, of course, this morning, got to start with the Jim Crow mass incarceration emergency update. Anonymous has been on the web on Twitter, and they say that the name of the killer cop is Brian P. Willman. And the Ferguson cops are saying that's not the cop. So that's the latest. It's either Brian P. Willman or it's not Brian P. Willman. That shot and shot and shot Ron Davis. To give you the news you're not supposed to know, I'll turn to Al Jazeera's coverage, edited a bit, versus false balance. You know, he said, she said statements I took out. This is by Masood Hayoun for Al Jazeera. As outraged residents of Ferguson, Missouri, continue to protest a police shooting that left unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown dead. Michael Brown was shot. Pardon me. Ron Davis, the father of another slain black teen in Jacksonville, Florida, is aiming to shame the United States before the United Nations for murders committed with impunity against young black men. Davis' bid comes amid efforts in Ferguson to build a more than a century-old civil rights movement in response to Brown's killing that community leaders say never took hold in the greater St. Louis area. At the 85th meeting of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination in Geneva, Switzerland, on Wednesday and Thursday, that's today, Davis hopes to pressure Washington to bolster efforts to stop the phenomenon of what he and the United States Human Rights Network and the NGO backing him call the criminalization of race in America. The U.S. will be forced at the meeting to answer questions from Davis and the international community in what the American Civil Liberties Union told the press Wednesday was a singular opportunity to hold Washington accountable. So it's going to the U.N. Davis is angry, they write, over a spate of unpunished murders of young black men across the country, 6 months after Neighborhood Watch coordinator George Zimmerman was acquitted in killing of unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. Davis' son Jordan was killed at a gas station after he and his friends refused to lower the music in their car. The case brought against Jordan's killer, Michael Dunn, resulted in a mistrial. Sound familiar? Just speaking for myself, about every 28 hours... emergency. But returning to the article by Al Jazeera, these things eat at you that shouldn't have happened, and the people doing these transgressions are getting away with it. That's a quote of Davis, who's joined in Geneva by Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton. Ron Davis hopes to direct his anger over the deaths into a solution for African-American fathers who have come to teach their children to accept police brutality as a fact of life in the United States. Davis and the USHRN director hope that taking U.S. race issues to the international community will create political leverage in Washington. Quoting, we have a lot of people directly impacted by the violence. We have exhausted our domestic remedies. We have to take this to the United Nations. We have to see if we can leverage that pressure to see if we can get people to act on this issue. Talking about any issue as a human rights violation gets the attention of the U.S. government. It's embarrassing for the government that champions itself as a beacon of human rights in the world. So that's at Al Jazeera. And so continuing on the human rights emergency, Jim Crow incarceration crisis update, Portland Cop Watch has been trying to meet with the elected mayor of Portland. And as I've been mentioning over the last week or so, there have been emails going back and forth between Portland Cop Watch and the police department. And this email is from Officer Wesson Mitchell, Ms. Wesson Mitchell. She wrote, "We appreciate that the mayor confirmed that he wants to meet with us. However, it appears that he has not directly received the message that our group is not willing to do a clarifying meeting with you." Pardon me, this is a letter to Officer Wesson Mitchell. From Cop Watch, "to do a clarifying meeting with you and or other staff before such a meeting. It is not worth our time and certainly not 2 hours of our time to express our analysis of city and police bureau policies only to be told that we have, quote, a lack of information and a predisposition to bad intent, end quote. Make, quote, false overarching statements that are simply not true, end quote, full of, quote, misrepresentations and inaccuracies, end quote, or perhaps, quote, misinformation and mischaracterizations, end quote. What we've hoped for since your pledge on April 22nd is information that addresses our concerns if what we wrote, in fact, is somehow inaccurate. But it is clear that the issue that you disagree with is our analysis, not that we have our facts wrong." Quoting the letter, the email from Portland Cop Watch to Ms. Wesson Mitchell. And when I said quote and end quote, they, meaning Cop Watch, had provided dates for each one, July 31st, April 22nd, July 16th. These are quotes of statements that have been made to the press or to Cop Watch. And the letter ends, "We look forward to receiving the information you feel is necessary for meeting with the mayor, especially clarification on why the mayor did not bring the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force issue back to council once he decided not to obtain security clearance, which is what he promised this spring. Once the meeting with the mayor we've been requesting for 4 months has been granted, we assume you will be sitting with him and we will see you there." And that's signed Dan Handelman, Regina Hannon, Mike Tabor, and other members of Portland Cop Watch. So that's the local version. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? The Globe and Mail writes, after days of protests over the fatal police shooting of an unarmed, well, let me clarify here. The Globe and Mail writes, after days of protests over the fatal police shooting of a black teen in Missouri, activists named the officer they claimed to be responsible for Michael Brown's death on social media Thursday. And I just wanted to add that this is a fatal police shooting of an unarmed surrendering, laying on the ground, getting shot over and over person. Anyway, groups claiming to be associated with anonymous hacker activist group threatened to reveal personal information about the Ferguson, Missouri officer, such as his home address and photo. And departing from the article again, the name of the officer supposedly revealed by anonymous, if it was anonymous and if this is correct, is Brian P. Willman, W-I-L-L-M-A-N. The night before, police in Ferguson fired tear gas, stun grenades, smoke bombs to disperse through some 350 protesters. On the fourth night of racially charged demonstrations, some demonstrators hurled rocks at police as others scattered while smoke engulfed the area. And the Globe and Mail writes, a Reuters reporter saw two young men preparing what looked like gas bombs in a bus stop shelter, their faces covered by bandanas. Police said protesters had thrown gas bombs at officers. And Globe and Mail goes on to describe the military assault. If you've seen the photographs in the press, the soldiers that have been attacking protesters in Ferguson are apparently actually police, or they're assigned to police, but they are certainly, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. When you are in a squad, you're wearing camouflage and a helmet and a bullet vest, and they used to call them bulletproof vests. Now they call them ballistic, I imagine, over lawsuits. Anyway, when you're, you know, you got your combat boots on, your combat face on, and you got your assault rifle with a scope, and you're charging into the crowd, you're not a cop, you're a soldier. And I just want to point out that soldiers being deployed against U.S. citizens today have a little problem with this. Returning to the Globe and Mail article, police have deployed camouflage-clad officers in body armor, including one manning a rifle on a tripod atop an armored car at Ferguson. And departing again from the article, to confront people who are walking in the streets shouting and holding their hands up. Yeah, because you can't be too careful. But anyway, police have been slow to release information about Saturday's shooting of Michael Brown, except to say that it followed a struggle between the unnamed officer and Brown, and that the officer was treated at the hospital for a swelling on the side of his face. Police have declined to release the name of the officer involved in the incident, citing concerns for his safety. And as I was saying, the anonymous, the update is that his name is Brian P. Willman. Police Chief Thomas Jackson told reporters his priority was improving race relations. Yeah, he actually said that. In Ferguson, which has seen a stark demographic shift in recent decades, going from mostly white to mostly black. About two-thirds of the town's 21,000-strong population are black. On a police force of 53, three officers are black. So, Democracy Now! Reported earlier this morning that the Ferguson cops have been attacking and arresting reporters, even as they prepare their reports at a McDonald's restaurant. What happens, I have to ask, when years and years and years of attempts to peacefully address a murderous, suppressive race hatred regime fails? Do you get burning spear, like in South Africa? Do you get the FMLN, like in El Salvador? We will see increasing armed resistance. I'm merely describing normal and historic human behavior. People will resist, and probably people will organize resistance. That's what happens when the authorities fail to respond to reason over and over and over around the world, and across centuries this has happened. The secret police in the U.S. will try to infiltrate and control the phenomenon, but they'll fail to stop it. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Now I want to quote an article in Counterpunch on police militarism in America. Now, this is by Dave Lindorf. He wrote The Apparent Murder by a White Police Officer in Ferguson, Missouri, of Mike Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old black youth who was shot a number of times while he was allegedly on his knees with his hands up in the air, pleading, "Don't shoot, I'm not armed," is exposing everything that is wrong with policing in the U.S. today. The Ferguson Police Department, reportedly nearly all white, patrols a St. Louis suburban community that is largely African-American, which is already a recipe for disaster in a country that is drenched in racism. The Ferguson Police Department is reportedly using the kind of aggressive policing, arresting people over minor infractions that can quickly escalate into violent confrontations. In this case, it appears Brown's offense was jaywalking and perhaps talking back to the police officer. The first being a citation offense, and the second not even illegal. When this shooting happened, instead of immediately attempting to calm things down, the Ferguson Police Department went all paramilitary, sending massive numbers of up-armed cops and military gear into the community backed by armored vehicles. I want to stop there and point out that here in Portland, we have exactly the same situation. The police, yes, they do have an armored personnel carrier, at least. I've seen several of their armored vehicles during the Occupy Wall Street protests, and they bring them out to intimidate. And, you know, they are kind of handy for shooting people up. But returning to the article by Dave Lindorf in Counterpunch, the police responded to understandable community protests with tear gas and later with solid wooden and rubber bullets designed to hurt and injure but not kill, though clearly at close range there is always that danger. Several more people have already been shot by police, leaving them in critical condition. And departing from that text, the update, of course, that you can get the update on Democracy Now! Last night was pretty bad as well. And Lindorf writes, "What's wrong here? So many things it's hard to know where to begin. First of all, unless an officer is under attack or unless members of the public are threatened, there's simply no justification for a police officer to unholster a service revolver or worse, to fire at a person who is allegedly committing some minor offense. Nor even after having fired shots is there any justification for an officer to continue to fire at someone who is manifestly unarmed and who is not threatening anyone, as appears to have been the case when this officer continued to fire at the kneeling Brown." But so that's pretty mild words for emptying your gun at someone. Murdering is the word, I believe. Anyway, returning to the article, second, once a tragic outrage like this has occurred, it is totally unacceptable for the police department involved to withhold the information concerning the officer's identity. Police are not CIA agents. They're public employees responsible to the community in which they work. When they decide to become peace officers, they are signing on to be responsible members of the community they are policing. In a democratic society, they cannot be permitted to hide behind their badges. Public knowledge of who's doing what policing is a critical deterrent to the dangerous tendency for police to see themselves as in an oppositional role with respect to the community they are policing, as sort of an occupying army. And speaking for myself, occupying army is the theme it's the theme of the day, isn't it? You will obey. Returning to the article, Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson said he is withholding the name of the officer who killed Brown, and as I was saying earlier, that name has now been made public. It's already slipped my mind, so I think I'll just look it up again. Let's see here. What's the name of the officer? Brian P. Willman, according to Anonymous. And as I said, they're saying, no, it's not Brian P. Willman. The cops are saying that, and we know just exactly how credible they are. There's more on that article. You can find it at counterpunch.org. I want to go on to some other topics here. I want to talk about the information that has been presented, a word that I'm using lightly here, to the U.S. public about ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State, the ongoing warfare in Iraq, in other words, after all these years. Disinformation is what it is, but anyway, quoting Kurt Nimmo in Global Research, last month Time magazine posted an article refuting the claim ISIS, now the fully militarized Islamic State, is an intelligence operation. The article by war propagandist Aaron Baker states, "Conspiracy theories are nothing new in the Middle East. And Baker squarely places responsible for the declared conspiracy theory on Iran. According to Baker, the Iranians claim the ISIS offensive currently underway in Iraq is part of a U.S.-backed plot to destabilize the region and protect Israel. And speaking for myself, imagine that. Imagine the U.S. destabilizing the region and protecting Israel. Anyway, Baker says the IRNA and the Tehran Times believe the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden was responsible for uncovering details about Operation Beehive, also translated as Hornet's Nest, which is described as a joint U.S.-British and Israeli effort to create a terrorist organization capable of centralizing all extremist actions across the world. And Baker concludes there's no evidence within the Snowden trove of any such plot. She chalks the accusation up to another baseless internet rumor. And she writes, yet Iranian government officials and independent analysts on Iran alike cited IRNA's report as definitive proof of ISIS American and Israeli origins. Now, speaking for myself, that is the shape of the propaganda. And the propaganda in this case is trying to confuse you about what has actually happened. And Kurt Nimmo writes, evidence of IRNA and Tehran Times, however, making the claim is suspiciously absent. And he writes, the Snowden hoax is traced by Alan Kurtz to a German website and to a man named Karim Al-Baidani. A photo of Al-Baidani is used on the Facebook page of Abu Samir al-Baidani, identified by Kurtz as an Iraqi Shiite writer based in Munich, Germany, who may or may not be associated with an al-Alam television show, Iraq Today. And there's he goes into more detail about this attempt to say that ISIS is legitimate and that the information, the real information, actually, that ISIS was set up, of course, and you know, if you've been following the news, you remember that ISIS was set up, supported by the U.S. originally as a part of the counter to the Syrian government, part of the war there. He writes, the putative and mercurial leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was reportedly a civilian internee at Camp Buka, a U.S. military detention facility near Umm Qasr in Iraq. Now, former U.S. Air Force Security Forces officer and compound commander at Camp Buka said the camp created a pressure cooker for extremism. And circumstantial evidence, Dr. Kevin Barrett writes, suggests that al-Baghdadi might have been mind-controlled while held prisoner by the U.S. military in Iraq. In July, Nabil Naim, the founder of Islamic Democratic Jihad Party and former top al-Qaeda commander, told the Beirut-based pan-Arab TV station Al-Maidin, all current al-Qaeda affiliates, including ISIS, work for the CIA. And departing from this article, meanwhile, NPR's Dina Temple-Raston has quoted the CIA's InQtel as if it were an actual source of information instead of a source of disinformation. And she used their disinformation to slur Snowden as an al-Qaeda-connected person. And the point I'm trying to make here, actually, is that this information that ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State is a CIA asset or a military and intelligence asset of the Saudis and the CIA is real information. And the propaganda is that it's that it comes from Iran and that it comes from Snowden. No, it comes from reality. Returning to the article, in June, a Jordanian official told Aaron Klein of WorldNet Daily, ISIS members were trained in 2012 by U.S. instructors working at a secret base in Jordan. In 2012, it was reported the U.S., Turkey, and Jordan were running a training base for the Syrian rebels in the Jordanian town of Safawi. Key members of ISIS, it now emerges, were trained by U.S. CIA and Special Forces Command at a secret camp in Jordan in 2012. The U.S., Turkish, and the Jordanian intelligence were running a training base for the Syrian rebels in the Jordanian town of Safawi in the country's northern desert region, conveniently near the borders to both Syria and Iraq. Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the two Gulf monarchies most involved in funding the war against Syria's Assad, financed the Jordan ISIS training. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And there's more on that article, just a bit more here. A scripted geopolitical struggle between the U.S. and Russia is the objective of leading neoconservatives in the CIA, Pentagon, and State Department all along. The CIA transported hundreds of Mujahideen Saudis and other foreign veterans of the 1980s Afghan War against the Soviets in Afghanistan into Chechnya to disrupt the struggling Russia in the early 1990s, particularly to sabotage the Russian oil pipeline running directly from Baku and the Caspian Sea into Russia. James Baker III, remember him, and his friends in the Anglo-American Big Oil had other plans. It was called the BTC Pipeline, owned by BP U.S. Oil Consortium and running through Tbilisi into the NATO member Turkey, free of Russian territory. And, you know, there's so much more that is going on there. But I'm asking you to think about this current news, and this is speaking for myself. Think about the current news in context. We're supposed to believe that the Islamic State Army, which was created with Saudi money and U.S. direction during the war against the Syrian state, suddenly popped up with a great convoy of brand new Toyota trucks. Have you seen those pictures? Out of the blue. Without the NSA and NRO's satellites even able to see it in the clear desert air there on the road, and that the great deadly U.S. Air Force, which, as you may remember, slaughtered the entire Iraqi army all those years ago on the road of death, could not stop them. Do you remember the turkey shoot? You remember the crispy critters the military is so proud of when U.S. uranium pyrophoric munitions were used to burn people alive even as they were being shot? Those people were retreating. But they had more than just pickups, and they were slaughtered to a man. But now, the Islamic State is supposedly able to survive U.S. airstrikes. Just can't stop them with the airstrikes, which over the last week somehow barely affected them, as if they were supermen who could somehow hold off U.S. air power, wham, 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 merely with their will. And we were told that they were going to overrun the Peshmerga, who had previously been described, as you may remember, as efficient fighters, and who indeed have held off all comers to build their Kurdistan. Then, turned out yesterday, it's no big deal, really. The Yazidi on that mountain were fine, really. Not so many of them. And poof, the unstoppable Islamic State was stopped. And really what was happening is that Zbigniew Brzezinski's and the Pentagon's long-desired breakup of Iraq is in progress. And the Iranian-connected Shia government in Baghdad is being confronted with a Sunni faction, currently and temporarily allowed fighting room and supplies by the U.S. and the Saudis and the Jordanians so that the oil and gas pipelines can be managed by setting the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds up in little mini-Iraqs, which are already competing for oil profits. And the situation can change so rapidly because it's entirely within our minds, as we are being fed a line of pure manure. Look out! The Islamic State is going to attack New York with invisible flying elephants spewing chemtrails! Now, to catch up on a couple of articles, I'm going to skip Ebola this week, even though Ebola is not skipping this week. It's getting worse and worse, and I just want to comment that it's really worth watching what happens in Lagos. As goes Lagos, goes the world. Here's hoping that no one who is sick is going to be on one of those crowded city buses in Lagos. But anyway, this from Common Dreams. Following Israel's latest military assault on Gaza, civil society groups from around the world say they are moving forward with plans to break the blockade on the besieged strip by sailing a Freedom Flotilla into Gaza port. And speaking for myself, you may recall that the last Freedom Flotilla was shot up by the Israelis, even though it was entirely a peaceful effort, cowardly murdering, including U.S. citizen, adding to the death toll that started with the USS Liberty. Returning to the article, at a meeting in Istanbul, Turkey this week, the International Freedom Flotilla Coalition and numerous other groups came to the conclusion that it is the responsibility of civil society worldwide to sail to Gaza, according to a press statement. They committed to making the voyage during 2014, which has been coined by the United Nations as the International Year of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. While the group did not publicly disclose a launch location or date, they announced that they expect participation from civil society organizations across the globe, from Greece to South Africa to Jordan to Malaysia, as a counter to the complicity of world governments in the blockade on Gaza. Find that article at Common Dreams. And once again, the name of that is the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. And finally, Update on the bomb trains. Yes, they are still passing through the Portland area. Burlington, Northern Santa Fe recently said it would proceed with plans to increase speeds for oil by rail units to in Devil's Lake, North Dakota, to 60 miles per hour from 30, despite opposition from local officials. BNSF's announcement came merely a week after the Obama administration announced its proposed regulations. So watch out for the bomb trains. Stay tuned. More on KBOO Portland.
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m., at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me.
Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look here on KBOO.